This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Willie Nelson has written over 2,500 songs. We're going to talk about just a few of them. The occasion for his visit is his new book, The Tao of Willie, which he describes as his way of sharing a little of what he's learned in his 72 years of making music and friends. Nelson is famous for many things, from writing songs like Crazy, Nightlife, Hello Walls, and Funny How Time Slips Away, to organizing Farm Aid and touring on his bus powered by biofuels. Three of his CDs from the 70s, Shotgun Willie, Phases and Stages, and Live at the Texas Opry House, will be released with extras next month in a collection called The Complete Atlantic Sessions. It includes this song, Local Memory.
Lights go out each evening at 11, and up and down our block there's not a sound. I close my eyes and search for peaceful slumber, and just then the local memory comes around. Piles up blues against the door to make sure sleep will come no more. She's the hardest working memory in this town. Turns out happiness again and lets loneliness back in. And each night the local memory comes around. Each day I say tonight I may escape her. I pretend I'm happy and never even frown. But at night I close my eyes and pray sleep finds me. But again the local memory comes around. Rids the house of all good news, then sets out my crying shoes. What a faithful memory never lets me down. We're both up till light of day, chasing happiness away. And each night the local memory comes around.
That's Willie Nelson, a track from his album Shotgun Willie, and that's one of three albums about to be reissued on Willie Nelson, The Complete Atlantic Sessions. Willie Nelson, welcome back to Fresh Air. It's such a pleasure to have you back.
Thank you very much. Good to be back.
You know, there's a couple of people who have been on Fresh Air in the past year who've talked about how you changed their lives. And one of them was the songwriter and singer Billy Joe Shaver, who talked about how you helped him the day his son died. And what he said was he was told that his son died in a heroin overdose. But Shaver says that his son had fallen in with some bad companions, and he wasn't sure what really happened. And I want to play an excerpt of the tape here. I'd like you to hear this. And in this part, Shaver told me that the police took him to the hospital where his son was. And I'll let Billy Joe Shaver take the story from here. It's the story of the day of his son's death and how you helped him.
I don't know what happened. I really still to this day don't know what happened, and I tried to stay in there with him while they were checking to see if he was brain dead, and the police ran me off, and they wouldn't let me back in, told me they're going to arrest me. Oh, my God. And Willie Nelson, I got to give him credit. He's the one that talked me back out into the world. He said, come on, Billy. He said, you're supposed to play tonight. It's New Year's night. He said, I'll throw something together. And Willie sat up and played all night long. And I'd go up and sing every once in a while. I owe Willie a lot. He's been such a good friend. And he took me down to his house, and we spent the night there and hadn't talked in quite a long time. And he told me a lot of things because he knew a lot. He's a wise man. And he gave me some money. And you know, it's hard to be broke when you're in a situation like that. And then he paid for my son's burial, and I didn't have any money at the time. So I later got some money from Sony, and I was trying to pay him back, and he wouldn't take it.
That was Billy Joe Shaver on Fresh Air, the songwriter and singer, and my guest is Willie Nelson. And Willie Nelson, when Billy Joe Shaver told that story, and he talked about how on the day his son died, you got together a band and basically forced him to perform that night. It made me wonder if part of the reason that you did that was because you thought that the stage was the only safe place for him that night. Because it sounds like he was so upset about his son's death that he might have drunk himself into a bad place or done something, taken some action that he might have lived to regret.
Well, I always find that on the stage is the safest place for me. No matter what I've been into, if I get up there for a couple of hours, I can sometimes work it out. Most of the time during the show, I can sort of clear my mind of whatever. So I knew that at this particular time, Billy Joel needed to be working. This wasn't a good time to be laying around thinking about things.
So how do you put together a concert on the night of his son's death? I mean, what kind of music seemed appropriate for him and for you? I don't know if you even remember.
Well, I do remember very well, and it wasn't the music itself wasn't anything out of the ordinary. I did some of my songs, and then occasionally Billy Joel would come up and do one of his. But it was mainly the fact that we were out there, we were at this club, and we were trying to make the best of a really bad situation. And I figured that was the best way that I could help Billy Joel, was just to get him back on the stage singing and playing and sort of living in the moment again and forgetting about what just happened, if he could.
Did the audience know what had happened?
I think most everyone there knew what had happened, and they were all, you know, happy to see Billy Joel there, because they also knew that this was where he needed to be, out with friends, fans, rather than trying to hole up somewhere.
I figure you must have known something about what Billy Joe Shaver was going through, because you lost a son, too. Did you perform after that? Did the stage seem like the best place for you?
Yeah, right after my son died, I had a gig booked in Branson, Missouri, and it was on New Year's Eve, and he died on Christmas, so it would have been real easy for me to cancel and go off somewhere and you know, grieve alone somewhere for months or a long time. I could have done it. It would have been the easiest thing to do, but I didn't. I just knew instinctively that my best place to be was somewhere on the stage, and it just so happens that I had a six-month gig there in Branson, Missouri, so I had 6 months, and I think it was the best place for me, especially at that time.
You have so many great records. It was really hard to narrow down what songs I wanted to play during your Fresh Air visit today. But here's one I know I want to play. There's a great album that came out about 3 years ago called Crazy, the Demo Sessions, and it's demo recordings that you made after you were a DJ, when you got to Nashville, and these are some of them are from the early 1960s. This one is. It's from 1961, and the song is called Opportunity to Cry. It's just voice and guitar. Do you remember making this?
Sure. Was this the cut that we did in Nashville, or was this a later cut?
Well, you know, on the liner notes, I think it says that all they know is that it was... They think it's recorded in your office.
It probably was, because I did a lot of recording downtown, or not, actually it was out in Goodlettsville, out of a place called Pamper Music, where the publishing company was. And I did a lot of writing and playing, sitting around in a garage back there that had been converted into a studio. So that's probably where I was.
Okay. Well, let's hear it. This is Willie Nelson, recorded in 1961. It's a demo of his song, Opportunity to Cry.
Just watch the sunrise on the other side of town. Once more I've waited, and once more you've let me down. This would be a perfect time for me to die. I'd like to take this opportunity to cry. You gave your word, now I'll return it to you with this suggestion as to what you can do. Just exchange the words I love you to goodbye, while I take
this opportunity to cry. I'd like to see you, but I'm
That's Willie Nelson and a demo recording he made of his own song in 1961 when he was trying to interest people in recording his songs. What was the fate of that song? Did anybody ever do it?
I don't think anybody done it but me. I've recorded it maybe a couple of times since then on various, a couple of different albums. I don't remember what they were right at the moment, but it was one of those really sad, almost pitiful songs.
In your new book, you write, "I've always had my own way of singing, and it was nothing like the way other Nashville stars sang." What did people think of your singing on the demos before you recorded yourself?
Oh, I think a lot of the musicians understood what I was doing, and my phrasing was a little different, and my chords were a little strange, too. There weren't your normal three-chord country songs, and that was a little strange for a lot of the people in the industry at that time, because country and pop hadn't really melted together like they have today in some instances. So a song with a lot of chords in it wasn't considered to be that commercial. So I had fun trying to get those songs done in that kind of atmosphere.
When you said that your singing was different and your chords were different, do you think that the chords and the singing were more jazz-inflected in some ways, and had you listened to a lot of jazz?
Well, I have listened to a lot of different kinds of music, and I grew up listening to everything from Frank Sinatra to Hank Williams. So I'm sure I picked up a lot from, every one of those guys. I lived across the street from a whole gang of great Mexican friends of mine who played music all the time, so I was influenced by all that music. I worked in the fields with all kinds of people who sang and played in practically every language, from Bohemian to Spanish. So I heard all kinds of music. It was like being in an opera out there in the cotton fields and hearing all that music coming at you all day long. So it was picking cotton wasn't that fun, but the music out there was incredible.
Did you sing when you were picking cotton?
Oh, at the top of my voice.
Yeah. What would you like to sing?
Oh, I would sing what they were singing, They would be singing over there, singing some blues, and I would sing some blues with them. I had no idea what I was doing, but I was trying to sing, and I would sing songs that I knew back then, and I didn't know many songs other than gospel songs back then, and I sang, Amazing Grace and songs like that.
My guest is Willie Nelson. He has a new book called The Tao of Willie. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Willie Nelson. Now, in your new book, The Tao of Willie, you say that you wrote your first cheating song when you were 7, long before you knew firsthand anything about broken hearts and cheating. When you started writing songs when you were older, did you know anything about, the structure of a 32-bar song or what a bridge was like, how to write the bridge to a song? Did you think of the song in technical terms when you started seriously writing them?
No, I never did, and I still really don't. I just kind of write and sing and what I feel like writing, and my timing is pretty good, so I don't break meter that much, and my ear is pretty good, so I don't play a lot of wrong chords. But as far as the lyrics and the singing itself, everybody has to judge that for themselves. But back in those days, I was writing about things I had, like you say, at that age, I couldn't have possibly known what I was writing about, unless you happen to believe in reincarnation, which I do, and I thought maybe I come here knowing some things that I wrote about before I knew.
In talking about country songs, country songs have certain conventions in a way. A lot of country songs are about cheating or drinking too much or falling in love. I guess you could say the same thing about rock songs. Mm-hmm. But there's also a subcategory of country songs where you're feeling so bad, you're just overwhelmed with self-pity. And one of the most self-pitying of the self-pitying songs is a song that you wrote that's included on your demo sessions that I really want to play and hear the story behind. And so here it comes. This is Willie Nelson singing a very self-pitying song.
If I'd only had one arm to hold you, better yet, if I'd had none at all, then I wouldn't have two arms that ache for you, and there'd be one less memory to recall. If I'd only.
Then in the next verse, you imagine having only one eye, so he'd have only one eye to cry. Did you think of
that's
the song?
That's pitiful, isn't it?
Yes, so, so pitying. did you think that when you sat down to write this, that you would write the ultimate self-pitying song?
Well, actually, I didn't sit down to write that one. The way that song happened, I was lying in bed with Shirley, and I woke up in the middle of the night wanting a cigarette, and her head was on my arm. So I had to reach over on the side of the bed and get a cigarette and put it in my mouth and then get a match with that one hand and then try to strike that one match. So it all started from that.
Oh, because you only had one arm? Really? Is this really what
happened? That's true. That's a true story. So from the one arm, I went into the one eye, one ear, one leg.
That's really funny. And what was the fate of this song?
I recorded it a couple of times. Other people have recorded it. Merle Haggard recorded it. I think George Jones did. So it's got a pretty good history.
Now, you have a very recent CD, I guess I could call it a new CD, of songs by Cyndi Walker, who's most famous for You Don't Know Me and Bubbles in My Beer. Did you know her well? She died just at about the time your CD was released.
Yeah, and at the time we started doing this album, I had known her a long time. She's a very good friend, and I had talked to her, and we talked about doing an album of her songs for years. And she had sent me songs, and I had quite an accumulation of Cyndi songs, and I knew a lot of them. But I just hadn't got into the studio to do it, you know, for one reason or another. And I'm glad I did it when I did, because Cindy's health was deteriorating pretty well at that time, and I was just hoping that I could get the album completed and out while she was still here to listen to it. And as it happened, she did get to hear it before she died.
What did she have to say?
Oh, she loved it. She called me up and told me, you know, a lot of great things about how she enjoyed it, and she really made me feel good about getting it done.
I'd like to play a song from that CD, and I'm going to give you your choice of one of her two most famous songs, You Don't Know Me or Bubbles in My Beer.
Well, you know, Bubbles in My Beer is a great up-tempo song that I first learned from Bob Wills and the Texas Playboys. I had no idea who wrote the song when I started singing it, but I was a huge Bob Wills fan, and I just tried to sing and play every song that they recorded. So when Bubbles in My Beer came out, it was a natural, because I was, you know, beer joint club player. So naturally, it was a good song for where I was playing. And it still is. It's a great piece of literature. And so let's play Bubbles in My Beer.
Good enough. And this is from Willie Nelson's CD of songs by Cyndi Walker.
Tonight in a bar alone I'm sitting, apart from the laughter and the cheer, while scenes from the past rise before me, just watching the bubbles in my beer. And I'm seeing the road that I've traveled, a road paved with heartaches and tears, seeing the past that I've wasted while watching the bubbles in my beer. A vision of someone who loved me, brings a long silent tear to my eyes as I think of the heart that I've broken and of the golden chances that have passed me by. Oh, I know that my life's been a failure and I've lost everything that made life dear. And the dreams I once dreamed now are empty as the bubbles in my beer.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Willie Nelson. He has a new book called The Tao of Willie. Three of his CDs from the 70s, Shotgun Willie, Phases and Stages, and Live at the Texas Opry House, will be released next month on a collection called The Complete Atlantic Sessions. From the live recording, here's Nelson singing a song he co-wrote with Waylon Jennings.
Well, a long time forgotten, her dreams I just fell by the way. And the good life he promised ain't what she's living today. But she never complains of the bad times or the bad things he's done. She just talks about the good times they've had and all the good times to come. She's a good-hearted woman in love with a good-time man. And she loves him in spite of his ways that she don't understand. And through teardrops and laughter, they're gonna pass through this world hand in hand. This good-hearted woman in love with a good-time.
In your new book, The Tao of Willie, you write in praise of marijuana. You write, the highest killer on the planet is stress, and there aren't many people in America who don't medicate themselves one way or another. Some people choose an occasional beer or a little pill the doctor prescribes, and I'm not knocking that, but the best medicine for stress is pot. And then you go on to say that alcohol and a lot of prescription drugs don't agree with you, but marijuana does. Are you afraid to talk that way, afraid that, like, you'll be busted?
Oh, I have been busted. More than once. It was just minor amounts, so a fine, whatever. There was a time, though, when, especially in the state of Texas, when a couple of seeds could get your life. But things have lightened up a little bit. You have people out there who are sharper now who realize that there's a slight difference between marijuana and heroin. But the fact that you can use it for fuel. You know, I drove a Cadillac across Kentucky one time on hemp oil.
You're full of surprises when it comes to biofuels. what are you driving with now?
I think we're driving soybeans right now. I think we buy biodiesel wherever we can find it, and usually most of the biodiesel that we find is made from soybeans.
How did you start doing that, like using alternative fuels? It's become one of the things that you're famous for.
It hadn't been that long ago, maybe 3 years ago, my wife came to me and said, I want to buy this car that runs on biodiesel. And I said, what the hell is that? She said, well, it's vegetable oil. And I thought she was, been on that Maui Wowie again, you know, so I said, you better make sure you're right on this one. So, but she bought a brand new Volkswagen Jetta. There's a business on Maui, and has been for many years now, where they go around all the restaurants and they collect the grease from the grease traps and they recycle it and turn it back into 100% pure vegetable oil, and you can put it right into your diesel car. She bought her car. I drove it. The tailpipe smelled like French fries. I said, wait a minute, we may be on to something here. So I bought a Mercedes, a brand new one, and I filled it right up with vegetable oil. And I think the Mercedes people shuddered a little bit when they first heard about that. because they wasn't sure themselves what this would do to their $60,000 automobile. But it has run perfectly. It runs cleaner. I get better gas mileage. You know, the president said we're addicted to oil. I don't think we're addicted. I just think that's the only thing we have had. So we're glad to find alternatives. So along with ethanol, biodiesel, your hydrogen, your windmills, all these different ways of making fuel combined will help us reduce our dependency on foreign oil.
Now, the last couple of summers, you've been touring minor league baseball parks with Bob Dylan. Are you going to do that this summer, too?
No, actually, I'm working with Fogarty through the summer. And
with John Fogarty?
Yeah. We worked a couple of years there in a row with Bob Dylan, and we did work a lot of those minor league ballparks, which is turned out to be a great idea.
What do you feel you and Bob Dylan have most in common as friends or as songwriters or lovers of music?
Well, I think all those things. He enjoys touring and playing probably as much as I do because he's always out here somewhere. And I enjoy his friendship because he's a great guy. He's a little shy and reserved, but, you know, so am I in a lot of ways, so I understand that. We've written a song together one time. We wrote a song called The American Dream. And it was written in sort of a different way, I guess, because he sent me the melody, a track that he'd already recorded where he just hummed a melody. And so the whole thing was like... So it was kind of a strange demo, but the track was great. So I wrote lyrics to his instrumental, and it turned out, I thought, pretty good. We recorded it here in New York just a month or so after we finished it.
My guest is Willie Nelson. Here he is with Bob Dylan singing Heartland, which they co-wrote.
There's a home place under fire tonight in the heartland, and the bankers are taking my home and my land from me. There's a big gaping hole in my chest now where my heart was, and a hole in the sky where God used to be. There's a home place under fire tonight in the heartland, with a well where the water's so bitter nobody can drink. Ain't no way to get high and my mouth is so dry that I can't breathe. Don't they know that I'm dying? Why ain't nobody crying for me? My American dream fell apart at the seams. You tell me what it means. You tell me what it means.
We'll continue our interview with Willie Nelson after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Willie Nelson. He has a new book called The Tao of Willie. I want to ask you about somebody else who you were very close to, and that's Johnny Cash. You knew him for years. You played together in the Highwaymen. How would you describe him as a friend?
Well, a friend is a friend. You know, a friend is with you, good or bad, any time. So John and I have always been friends, and whenever... You know, he called me up several times when he's having a bad day just to hear a joke. And so I tell him my latest dirty joke. And I tried to make it as dirty as possible so he would laugh louder.
You actually must collect jokes or something, because, like, your new book, for instance, is filled with jokes, literally jokes.
Well, I believe in jokes, you know. I think jokes are important and a necessity. You need to laugh at yourself, other people, life, death. You need to figure out a way to laugh at everything.
Do you tell a lot of jokes on stage?
No, I don't tell any jokes on stage.
How come?
I'm afraid that if I quit singing, people will leave. I don't think they came to hear me tell jokes. You
know? That's funny. Did someone in your family tell jokes when you were growing up?
Yeah, that was our entertainment. That was before TV. We just sit around and tell jokes to each other and play dominoes and tell more jokes and play dominoes.
And sing too?
And sing, yeah.
Did the family sing together?
Oh, yeah. My grandfather was a great singer. My grandmother sang. My mother and dad were both singers, too. But I sang quite a bit in my early life with my sister. We played guitar and piano, and I would sing. And my grandfather died when I was 6 years old. So after that, we'd sit around and play piano, and my grandmother would teach sister how to play the piano, and I'd sit there on the piano stool and try to learn the chords along with her as she was reading the music.
You know, for some of us, singing is an incredibly self-conscious experience. It must be so natural to you, having grown up in a house where what people did was they got together and they sang together.
Yeah, it is natural, and they were voice teachers, so that's, you know, we talked
about
singing.
Your parents? Your parents were voice
teachers?
Yeah,
my grandparents were, they were great voice teachers, and my grandmother was great in teaching you deep breathing and breathing and singing from way down in the diaphragm, and these were just natural things that we were taught growing up, is how do you breathe, and the better your lungs are, the more you can hold a note and the more control you have.
Wow, so you didn't even have to break bad habits. You just started off with the right ones.
I was a very fortunate young guy.
How did your grandparents communicate breathing from the diaphragm when you were a child?
Well, they just said breathe from the diaphragm, and they would hold their hands down around their lower abdomen there, where I suppose that's where your diaphragm is, and so I would sing from as low down as there as I could.
I want to ask you a little bit. You know, your new book is called The Tao of Willie, referring to the Tao Te Ching, which is, you know, an ancient book of Chinese wisdom. I think the first song that you ever sold was The Family Bible. Do I have that right?
Right, right.
And so, you know, the Bible has literally played a role in your songwriting career. What kind of role did it play, like, in your home when you were growing up?
It was a great role that it played. My grandparents were huge gospel singers and writers, and they Sunday school teachers, and they, you know, always had gospel music, singing it and playing it, listening to it on the radio, singing it in church. And the Bible was there, and it was read all the time. I was a Sunday school teacher, so I, you know, started reading the Bible more and more and teaching it in class. So, yeah, I grew up reading the Bible.
And has it inspired any songs other than The Family Bible?
Oh, I don't, I guess probably, maybe in some way or another, it maybe inspired all songs. I believe every song is gospel, so everything I write, I hope, is gospel.
How did you start reading books of Chinese wisdom and start meditating?
One of the things that I was wondering about when I was going to church and teaching Sunday school was, I knew that I was a Christian, but I knew that there was millions of people out there who were other religions, and I wanted to find out about those other religions. So I did a lot of research in the Bible, and in the library, and read about different religions. I read about all the religions I could find, and also read things by Cahil Gibran and Edgar Cayce. They talked about reincarnation, and it made so much sense to me to believe that, you know, this one time through, there's no way you can get it right. It's kind of like going to school. You pass the first grade, you go to the second grade. And, you know, I'm probably somewhere around the fourth grade right now, still coming back. And so I believe that's the only thing that makes sense, is you do get a chance to come back. And it's not a chance. You are forced to come back and learn the lessons that you didn't learn the last time.
Let me bring this back to your songwriting. Are you still writing a lot of songs?
I'm probably writing a quantity is as many as I maybe. Well, back in the 60s, I was writing a whole lot more songs than I do now, but I still write, you know, a few songs every year.
And
I have a new song now. The one I just wrote now sort of goes along with the book. It's called It's Always Now. And nothing really goes away, and everything is here to stay, and it's always now.
When you write songs, are you sitting down and working in a craftsmanlike way on the song, or are they just kind of coming to you while you're doing things?
I used to, when I was driving myself to different gigs around the country, I would do a lot of writing just driving down the highway. And I still think, you know, that that's the best way for me to write. I can get in the car, I believe, and take off driving and head anywhere and start thinking about something. And if I'm lucky, I'll write a song. But I have to get somewhere by myself to do it. And there's a lot of things going on, a lot of interruptions and things that makes it difficult to do and just, you know, riding the bus.
And what about writing the music part, like the chords, for instance? Do you need a piano or a guitar when you do that?
If there's a guitar or a piano around, I would use it, but I can usually write it all in my head, and then I'll get a guitar when I find one and go over the lyrics and the melodies and probably wind up changing it several times before I finally decide this is the way I want it.
But from what you said before, it sounds like, I mean, do you ever, like, actually write it down?
I do now more than I used to. I used to have this theory that, well, if you don't remember it, it ain't worth remembering. But later on in life, I figured out, well, maybe I should jot down this one because I don't want to forget it.
Willie Nelson, it's been a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you. It's nice to talk to you again.
Willie Nelson's new book is called The Tao of Willie.